You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're talking for a full hour, I'm very pleased to say, with Paul Sperry, the editor-in-chief of CounterJihad.com, also a columnist for the New York Post and the author of several really important books, including Infiltration, How Muslim Spies and Subversives Have Penetrated Washington, and Muslim Mafia, Inside the Secret Underworld That's Conspiring to Islamize America. Paul, we've been talking about the Saudis, the insights that we had into what appears to have been a role they played in the 9/11 attacks. You were just describing that this is evidence that suggests indirectly ties using cutouts, using, well, the tradecraft of espionage, I'd say, to perhaps conceal some of their involvement. But the dots properly connected, it would seem, even in this redacted 29-page document, is pretty damning, is it not?
Yeah. I mean, you have everybody who, the FBI and the CIA, who were quoted the reports in this 29 pages, they're talking about these two Saudi nationals who were in San Diego as intelligence officers. And so they would have worked directly through the intelligence ministry, and that's Prince Turki. That's his portfolio. And then you have, and that's the brother-in-law of Bandar. Bandar's father, at the same time, is Prince Sultan. He's overseeing the defense and aviation cutouts that these guys were working for as cutouts. That's where they were getting their money, big gobs of money. They didn't work. Everybody who knew them said they didn't actually work and for these companies, and yet they were getting paid a lot of money. Money then was also coming in through the Saudi embassy from Bandar's personal accounts as well. So you have really a troika there of Prince Sultan, Prince Turki, and Prince Bandar that are indirectly connected to this 9/11 conspiracy and the hijackers. So,
and it's just unbelievable to me that this has not received closer scrutiny, a public debate before now. Paul, your contributions to this at counterjihad.com with an excellent précis of what is in that 29 pages is really appreciated. Paul, you have been, as I've indicated, involved for many years in trying to figure out what the nature of this global jihad movement is, not just historically, but what it's up to at the moment. How would you characterize the role being played by the government of Saudi Arabia and its nationals in that global jihad at the moment?
Well, since we never got to the bottom of their role in 9/11, clearly there was a terrorism support network set up and an infrastructure that involves not just the Saudi embassy, but the consulates, but also their Saudi-funded mosques. And that really becomes apparent when you read those 29 pages, that the mosques were involved in, you know, money laundering, terror support. The hijackers went to a lot of back and forth bi-coastal to Saudi-funded, Saudi-built mosques. And, who were these people? Were they all kicked out of the country? Were they deported? Are they still in place in the embassy and the consulates? Are they still in place in the mosque? We don't know, because no one got to the bottom of what the Saudi role in 9/11 was. And, you know, quite frankly, we need to have another, reopen the 9/11 commission at a minimum, because obviously they missed a lot. They did not connect the dots when it came to the Saudis, if you read that report. And no one has refuted any of this information that's in the 29 pages. In other words, no one's come in and said, no, this is totally inaccurate. These bank accounts, these bank records, these phone records, these are all, garbage. No, it's all there. It just was never pursued aggressively to get to the next layer.
And yet there has been some effort made, including, I'm thinking, by the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Governor Tom Kaine of New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, former congressman, to sort of poo-poo this material in the 28 pages, both historically and more recently. And again, I think this is interesting and important to get sorted, no question about it. But let me just ask you about the present danger. And you've mentioned Saudi financing of U.S. mosques. Paul Sperry, would you talk about how that financing takes place and what control over the mosques it translates into for a kingdom that is evidently pretty damn hostile to the United States?
Extremely. And we haven't even talked about the immigration jihad they're doing. But let me go back to, let me come back to Hamilton and Kane. Hamilton, at least, has publicly admitted he's never even read the 29 pages. This is before they were declassified. So, I mean, these, it sounds like the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission didn't even know about them. And yet they're trying to poo-poo them. So they never even personally read them when they had the opportunity back
That's
when they were doing that investigation.
Yeah, especially since they're making public pronouncements about it or were before.
I mean, it's all very, very strange. Anyway, so on the mosque front, the money comes in, a lot of it comes in through the North American Islamic Trust. It's a big Saudi-funded, it's basically the bank for the Muslim Brotherhood in America. This is a group that's based out of Illinois, and they are the trustee. They hold the keys to most of the mosques and almost all of the radical mosques that are factories for jihadists in this country. If you look at some of the worst mosques in this country, like Dar al-Hijra, the 9/11 hijackers mosque and just outside of Washington, they are owned and controlled. Deeds are owned by NAIT, N-A-I-T, North American Islamic Trust. And there's, of course, a lot of other ways, entities through which the money is laundered into the terror support networks.
What does the control by NAIT translate into in terms of, say, you know, what's preached in those mosques, by whom, the curriculums for the various madrasas associated with these mosques, and so on, Paul Sperry?
Yeah, the control is financial, it's doctrinal, as you say, and it's personnel. I mean, they control who gets to be the prayer leaders and who sit on the board, the trustees, the directors of these mosques. If you look into their background, they're all Muslim Brotherhood figures going way back to when they first came into this country under the Muslim Students Association. And, this is a forerunner of ISNA and
the Islamic Society of North America, right. And Paul, to the extent that these groups, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Students Association, the North American Islamic Trust, and the like, have benefited from funding from Saudi Arabia, how is that provided? I keep hearing about something called the Muslim World League, and what role does it play?
Yeah, the Muslim World League is a Saudi government entity. Saudis have to try and, you know, once they got in trouble and there was a movement to get them designated as a foreign terrorist organization, there was a lot of lobbying, counter-lobbying by the Saudi lobby, K Street, to try and stop that from happening. And one of their ways they did that was, oh, no, this is just a charity. No, it's directly controlled in Riyadh by the kingdom.
And funded, and as I understand it, funded as a line item in the royal budget. Hey, Paul, we have to pause for another second. We'll come back with more with this Muslim World League and what it says about what the Saudis do and will do if not stopped inside America. That and more with Paul Sperry, the editor-in-chief of counterjihad.com and also a columnist for the New York Post, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.